Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with the economist Chris Canavan, who's currently managing director of Lion's Head Global Partners. Prior to this, he was director of global policy development for George Soros. And earlier in his career, he spent 13 years at Goldman Sachs, where he served as the chief risk officer.
He's also currently the chair of the board of trustees at Oberlin College and at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. And he's a lifetime member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Chris is really the perfect person to be speaking to about the economy right now. I mean, he's someone with a true whole earth perspective. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Chris. Welcome to At a Distance. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Spencer. Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
We wanted to start kind of because Andrew and I have a pretty pedestrian understanding of the current moment when it comes to economics and the financial situation. And we were hoping maybe you could help us understand and the listeners understand with greater clarity what's happening in this moment.
Well, I think that you've come to the wrong place. I think someone who has a formal training in economics, as I do, is perhaps the last person you should be asking what's going on. And not because we're dumb, but because I was trained in mainstream economics. I have a PhD from 30 years ago or so, and I spent some time teaching economics. And I spent a decade and a half or so on Wall Street extolling mainstream economics. And over the past decade, I've come to realize that all of that training, all of that preparation is probably exactly the wrong kind of preparation to really understand what's going on now. Because most of the economics that I learned and that most economists learn, in a sense, are an understanding about how the economy works in normal times. And we're not obviously in normal times. We're not in normal times economically, socially, biologically, and in many other ways. But the framework that I was taught, the sort of framework in which everyone behaves rationally and we process information rationally and we go about our day thinking about the future the way you might count cards at a casino and do cost-benefit analysis and all of the rest, and that this all somehow, as we interact miraculously, leads us to some balance, some equilibrium that's stable. All of that really has to be set aside to understand what's happening in a world in which all of that activity just comes to a sudden screeching halt. At the same time, everywhere in the world, I don't think that any economist who is purporting to understand what's going on is telling the truth, either to you or to themselves, frankly. So we're learning a lot. And in fact, I think for economists, or certainly economists like me, those who have over time become more skeptical of what we were taught, this is a very interesting moment, because when the world economy comes to a screeching halt, when all of this economic activity just is frozen in its tracks, it's an opportunity for us to get a kind of unobstructed view of what happens at the core of our economic existence. And we see it not because it's there, but because it's no longer there.
Right.
And very often we don't notice the presence of something until we notice its absence. And so, and I think that's what this pandemic is for the economics profession. It's an opportunity to come to the realization that there is much about economic activity that we haven't talked about over the past, pick your time period, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, because we haven't noticed its absence. And yet, in noticing its absence, hopefully we come to a better appreciation of its presence when it's there, and then think about how to understand that better, to invest in it, and all of the rest.
Right.
I don't know whether that's a satisfying answer to your question. I suspect it's a very unsatisfying answer to your question, but it's the best I can come up with.
Well, I think it's very telling of this moment. And I think another major absence that a large population is feeling is unemployment right now. Mm-hmm. You know, the workforce and the U.S. jobless claims hitting mm-hmm. almost 3.3 million. Mm-hmm. The previous record was 695,000 in 1982. Mm-hmm. So how do you view this situation from the workforce perspective? Like, how do we rebound in the aftermath of something like this?
And that's the key, right? Because I think the economic framework that I was just describing would probably have you believe that because this shock was a bolt from the blue, and because the public health specialists tell us that sooner or later it'll be gone, we naturally assume that the rebound should be pretty quick, right? That people aren't working now because all of the coffee shops are closed, but as soon as the coffee shops are open again, they'll go back to work. And before long, we'll be back in the old normal, not in some new normal. Mm. When I was referring to kind of noticing the absence of something and understanding the presence afterwards, it has to do with how we rebound, right? The rebound, the way in which 3 million, 4 million, 5 million people who have lost their job will get their job back is going to require a kind of coordination effort of staggering proportions, right? Mm-hmm. Because the coffee shop can't really reopen unless the company that supplies coffee beans and baked goods reopens. But that company can't reopen until, you know, the trade lines with Central American coffee producers and with roasters get reestablished. And they may have a hard time getting reestablished because they've lost credit to, you know, buy fertilizer and the rest. And so you can trace out all of these daisy chains that together construct this big web of economic relationships, which we call an economy. But you begin to appreciate the fact that there isn't some central godlike figure saying, okay, now everyone back to work simultaneously at the same time. And if that doesn't happen, and everyone's waiting for someone else to take the first step, then you can quickly see how this rebound, the so-called rebound, could be stretched out over a very, very long period of time as all of these micro decisions are made, and are made with people wondering whether, you know, so in China right now, it may well be that they can start up many of the factories that were shut down because people can begin going back to work. But of course, those factories are producing goods that are being sold into the U.S. market, but the U.S. market is shut down, right? And so even if there are Chinese workers who are now either healthy enough or safe enough to be able to go back to work, they can't go back to work if those factories are producing goods and services for which there is no longer a market. And you can think of a million examples of that. So I think what's scary about this is that a shock that was the quintessential temporary, transitory, completely exogenous bolt from the blue shock, which wasn't even an economic shock, it's a biological shock, will come and go, but it'll have really long-lasting economic consequences because we have a system that isn't very well equipped for this kind of shock and therefore will allow something that's temporary nevertheless have quasi-permanent consequences.
I mean, one of the things we're really talking about is that what this moment reveals is that we're all connected on a planet scale. And so, you know, is there an opportunity here that this is going to push us as a species towards more kind of whole earth thinking as we rebuild mm-hmm. and possibly understand some of the blind spots that led to this?
Mm-hmm. I hope so. I think that's the opportunity. I think that's the opportunity on lots of different levels, but certainly on the level of the economy. The metaphor I often use is, you know, in mainstream economists like to think that everything tends back to a stable equilibrium, like you've dropped a marble into a bowl and you know that the laws of physics and gravity will cause that marble to sort of settle at the bottom of the bowl. And if you nudge the bowl, the marble will move away, but it'll roll back. And so if you're confident that it'll roll back all the time, then after a while, you don't really care about the curvature of the bowl, right? You just know there's enough curvature, the sides of the bowl are high enough that if you nudge it, the marble will move but roll back. Hmm. Well, we didn't just experience a nudge. We experienced a bump of seismic proportions, one that has probably caused that marble not just to roll up the side of the bowl but out of the bowl, and now it's kind of wandering around somewhere. And getting it back into that bowl is no mean feat. And so hopefully what that leads to is us as economists, as social scientists, to say, you know what, maybe we should have paid more attention to the size of the bowl, to the curvature of the bowl, to the height of the bowl. Maybe we should have paid more attention to all of those qualities of the economy, which allow the economy to withstand a shock like this. All of those qualities that we refer to as kind of resiliency, we used to call it safety nets. Hmm. But over the decades, we, especially economists, have persuaded ourselves that safety nets could get smaller and smaller because the normal operation of the market economy meant that if we got moved away from this stable, balanced equilibrium, the market forces would almost immediately push us back. That turns out not to be the case, right? And that's why, to me, this shock is very much akin to the shock of the Great Depression, which was a financial shock in 1929, which, had there been a safety nut, had there been better devices to kind of coordinate economic activity, might not have led to practically a decade of economic despair. We lost all of the insights that came from that experience over the, you know, two or three generations between then and now. And I, in a way, fear, but also hope that we'll look at the experience now and say we have to regain some of those insights. We have to once again think about what it means for an economy to be resilient, what it means for an economy to be able to invest in all of those institutions, all of those mechanisms, all of those programs and policies and state capacity that are incredibly valuable when you're trying to recover from a shock like this.
What does a global collaborative effort even look like? You know, how do we, at this moment in time with such division, even conceive of the idea of working in tandem to solve this?
Well, I think there are two questions there, not one. I think it's probably a little bit easier to imagine what it looks like, but really difficult right now to imagine where the global leadership will come from in order to put it in place. If we go back to the Depression and its aftermath, that the global leadership that came about in order to create these mechanisms at a global level really came about at the end of the war, the Second World War, when the victors could sit around in a room and, having just experienced all of this trauma, the Depression and then the war, could relatively easily set aside nationalist impulses and say, we've got to try to construct some global architecture that can help us withstand, well, actually help us avoid the kind of horrible 15 or 20 years we've just experienced. And so, for example, that was when the institutions we associate with Bretton Woods were established, the World Bank, the IMF, which, for all of their faults, were an attempt to create these safety nets that are at a global level, so that when countries came into financial difficulties, there was an institution that could provide financial support. But those kinds of institutions, and even just the informal ones, right, the summits, the G7, the G8, the G20 summits, where leaders could sit around a table and say, okay, we're having to grapple with something that no one country can grapple with alone, and we've got to construct some informal way of dealing with it. Even that capacity for symmetry of that kind is really missing now. So I despair.
So back to kind of the moment now. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on, you know, these ideas of kind of just shutting down the economy for a month, like on a federal level?
Well, I don't know that we have any choice, because I do think that we have to get back to basics. And right now, the basic imperative is to save lives. And we know that if this epidemic peaks in the way it would if we did nothing about it, that it would overwhelm even the most sophisticated health systems, and that lots of people would die. And lots of people would die not just of the coronavirus, but of lots of other ailments and medical emergencies that they might otherwise survive from, because there's just no capacity. So I think that we don't have any choice to do that. I do think that it does challenge us as economists, as social scientists, to rethink some of the fundamental assumptions that we make.
Yeah.
Economists like to essentially assume that any two things can be compared by ascribing value, some kind of monetary value. And if you can do that, then you can decide which one is more valuable than the other one, and you can make choices about that. And I've, you know, occasionally I think about this if I'm on a train, for example, and I think, you know, suppose you're on a train from New York to Washington, and the train has to stop somewhere because one person on the train, which otherwise has 500 people on it, is suffering a heart attack, and that person requires immediate medical attention, and the entire train has to stop. So 499 people will not make it to a meeting on time, will not make it to Washington for whatever they're going to, except maybe an hour or so later. How do you think about that? I think most of us think the other 499 people, no matter what the price they have to pay for that 1 hour delay, even if you add up all of those costs, it still doesn't even come close to the value of saving one life.
Mm. Yeah.
But when President Trump says there is such a thing as too costly a shutdown, I think he's making the same calculation you would make on that train, but he's coming to a different conclusion. He's coming to the conclusion that it may not be worth saving that life if there are many other people being put out a little bit or a lot. And that's not meant to be a kind of a slap at Trump. That, I think, and I don't know that Trump meant it this way, but I think that that's a real challenge to the way we think about the economy, right? Because we tend to believe that we have the capacity to compare just about anything, any two things, in relative terms. And now we're coming to terms with the fact that certain things are just fundamentally valuable,
yeah,
and shouldn't be traded off for other things.
Hmm.
That's a realization we don't have to think about every day, thankfully, but we do have to think about now. But it's a reality all the time. We make those kinds of choices all the time.
You mentioned despair earlier, and I'm curious, this moment of like anxiety and fear we kind of find ourselves in, what do you think the pandemic is revealing about that, and how do we respond to this, much of which is unexpected in a way?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's a good question. My guess is that we will go through phases. I think my 10-year-old still thinks that this is an extended snow day vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we still sort of like the ability that we can, those of us who can come to work in our pajamas if we want to. But I do feel that over time, this sense of isolation will start to really have a cost. For many people, it has already, but for more and more, it will, and create a sense of despair. Again, it's waking up to the realization that we had something we didn't notice until we lost it. You know, one of my other gigs is as the chair of the board of my college, my alma mater. Oberlin College, exactly. And the president of Oberlin was recently asked in an interview whether she felt that shipping students back home, forcing them into remote learning would be a kind of fill-up, would be a an additional impulse towards a future in which that is the norm for higher education, where you don't show up, but rather you log on. It'll be a further undermining of this proposition that actually showing up and being somewhere for 4 years isn't all that valuable. And she said, and I completely agree, that in fact, it could have the opposite effect, that we don't realize the value of community. We don't realize how much we learn, how much we get out of showing up, being with other people, engaging in sort of intellectual jam sessions, in Oberlin's case, musical jam sessions, and being forced to do that every 12 months again, right? We'll appreciate the value of what it means to show up at the office and just have those random conversations, those random bowl sessions in which not only, you know, allow us to make the most of our ingenuity, but also represent a really important way in which we derive satisfaction from our work, right? And so it's the absence of that. It's the absence of that kind of satisfaction that comes with interacting with others that I think is going to feed into this despair. That is, of course, on top of all of the other much more important and much more obvious forms of a despair, which is that households that barely have $400 of savings and now have to figure out how to keep the landlord and the medical bills and all of the and the utilities at bay. I mean, that's really deep despair. But that despair was already there in this country.
And so much is going to depend on the attitude of that workforce to emerge from this. You know, after we're completely beaten down at the end of this quarantine, we're going to now need to get up and really work hard to build things back up. Mm-hmm. But really quick, back mm-hmm. to Oberlin, I was curious your perspective on how this might, you know, opportunistically, how this might shed a light on the importance of the humanities and the importance of liberal arts education in moments like these, because possibly some of the things that got us here was sort of these very myopic, narrow, mm-hmm. you know, points of view, you know.
Yeah, tunnel vision.
Everyone wanting to become an engineer because mm-hmm. that's where you get paid out of school. Mm-hmm. Will this teach us that we do need the philosophers, the social scientists, the people thinking about society from a broad perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly hope the answer to that question is yes. And I'm trying to do what I can to make sure that the answer is yes. In fact, I think that, you know, part of what we've been learning over time with the creation of this, you know, the informational economy, the digital economy, the virtual world, is that notwithstanding all of the great promise at the beginning, it's a bit like, you know, nuclear power. We ended up with the so-called dual use dilemma, right? It had enormous power for good, but enormous power for evil. And I think that we're just coming to terms with the really harmful consequences of that, but also the limitations of all of the kinds of knowledge that brought that about in the first place, right? The hard sciences, technology, engineering, and all of the rest. And we're hopefully beginning to appreciate that the way in which we understand how this is changing the world around us, that the tools, that the skills of understanding and observation that we need in order to really get our hands around that are not necessarily skills that you learn from the hard sciences, from engineering and the rest, as important as those skills are. But there are skills that you pick up when you study philosophy, when you study literary criticism, ways of observing, ways of capturing a phenomenon, right? I mean, an economist may, in everyday language, say, you know, someone will value a job more if they feel that there's some prestige that goes along with that job. Mm. But when you say, how do you measure prestige? Mm-hmm. They're lost, right? Because it's a concept that we all kind of understand, perhaps innately, but for which there is no tool in the economics toolkit that can capture it, right? So prestige is one. Despair, of course, is another. What does it really mean to experience despair? We know that there are correlates of despair, poverty. There are symptoms of despair, substance abuse, perhaps crime, but we don't really know what that concept is. And the economists and the engineers and the computer scientists don't really have very good tools for capturing despair, prestige, pride, those sorts of things. Whereas we have an entire set of fields that think about that all the time. And so I'd like to think that we'll see a renaissance, right? That the golden age of the humanities is not behind us, but rather ahead of us as we try to figure out these enormous challenges that face us, some of which are economic in nature, but many of which aren't.
I wanted to end on the subject of time as it relates to this current moment, and if, as an economist, it's shifted your thinking about time. And connected to that, there's this phrase that's common in the financial markets, where wherever there's a market slowdown, it's always taken as like a negative. And I'm wondering if you think instead it can actually be seen as a positive.
Slowing down?
Yeah.
Well, wow, okay. You want to end on this question? You should have begun on this question. because time and economics, I think, are probably merit an hour-long conversation in and of itself. I see what you mean, though, when you say the slowdown has a negative connotation, right? Because by that reasoning, a weekend should have a negative connotation, since the standard work week is 5 days, Monday through Friday, of course, not for everyone, and then we don't do anything Saturday and Sunday, and then we go back to work, and no one complains about weekends. in fact, we think that they have value. And we may actually be able to find that they have economic value. And so this notion that speed, right, is a virtuous economic phenomena is one that at best is not very well conceived. At worst, it's just horribly, horribly misunderstood. But there are other dimensions of time and economics that I think are also worth thinking about. So, for example, one of the things that many of us are spending our days doing is watching these graphs gyrate, right? The stock markets go up and down and up and down and up and down. And if you think of the stock market as at least the collective prediction of the future by a bunch of people who are buying and selling stock, right? Because that's, after all, what you're doing, right? When you buy a share, you think that the future is good for this company. When you sell it, you must think that the future is bad. So it's just your prediction of the future. But of course, it's not your prediction of the future. It's what you think everyone else is going to predict for the future. And yet there's no way in which our predictions about the future are gyrating so wildly as to create these zigzags on our screens, right? So somehow we think we're thinking about time and the future in a sensible way, but clearly we're not, right? Because otherwise these graphs would not be as crazy as they are. And so I'd like to think that, after all is said and done, we spend a little bit more time thinking about time in that way. And we're going to have a lot of time, because I also think that this coordination problem I was talking about at the beginning, where, we all have to move simultaneously, and yet moving simultaneously is going to be heroically difficult to do. So the timing of all of the steps that are required for this rebound are going to be really difficult to take, right? And so we've just underappreciated the notion of time. We just think it transpires in a linear way, and the more we get done, the better off we are. But I think that's a utterly simplistic way of thinking about it.
And the hubris that's developed in the last, say, 10 years about the prediction and modeling of the future, that's just so clearly fallen flat on its face in this. We can't model biology and the world.
We can't. Well, you're right. We can't model that. But we can't. It turns out we can't model a lot of other things that we hubristically thought we could model, right? And so we have to go back to the drawing board and figure it out all over again.
Well, we feel a little bit of comfort knowing people like you are involved in that conversation. And we really thank you for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us. We're hoping this can help put some people at ease by looking at this from a bit of a distance.
Well, I hope so. And I appreciate the time, and thank you for having me.
All right. Take care, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.